up next on the program, a guy who's rapidly becoming one of our favorite guests on the show. You've read his work in places like The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, Sports Illustrated, Slate, and many more. And he's a regular contributor to NPR's Weekend Edition. Colin Fleming joining us again on the program. Colin, welcome back.
Hello, Rich. How's it going?
Outstanding. We're going to have to give you your own seat here in the studio. You're on so much. That's great. We love having you on the show. And this time around, to talk Beatles, but especially to focus on the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, who passed away 50 years ago this coming Sunday.
Right. He is often called, well, he's one of the people who's a contender for that honorific of fifth Beatle. And he was certainly someone who put them well on their way. I'm not sure they would have become close to what they did without him, even though he was pretty flawed as a businessman. He always said he was more of an ideas person, and the Beatles subsequently found out later they lost a lot of money on a whole bunch of things, really, from royalties to merchandise. But I'm not sure that they would have been the world-altering collective that they were without his assistance.
Well, he saw them, I think initially, was it at the Cavern Club in about 1961, and saw something that he liked. But well, one of the things that he didn't like was their look. And that's one of the first things he did when he took over, was to change their appearance from the Teddy Boys look that they had fashioned prior to that.
Oh, yeah, he definitely didn't like their look at all. But no one was really, I guess, is informal would be the charitable word.
Yes.
In terms of their appearance. They would drink while on stage. This isn't just in Hamburg. This is wherever they played. There would be a cheese sandwich waiting to be eaten on an amp. They'd swear. They would stop a song because they were bored with it, and maybe one of their buddies was there and said, hey, could you play this one? And Epstein, he introduced the look with the suits and their shared bow they would do at the end of songs. And it took some persuading, less so ironically with Lennon, because as he said, he would do anything, and then he went on to name some things we can't discuss here in violation of the FCC, that he would do for money. So he was able to convince the rest of the band to go along with it.
And it helped too that he had some ins in the music industry. The family owned NEMS, the North End Music Store, which gave him the ability to promote them in a way that few other people could do.
Yeah, you would say, I guess, really, that Epstein at the time was posh, where the Beatles, it's been overstated how they grew up in sort of straitened circumstances. They didn't really say for Ringo, and he wasn't involved with them at this point, really, at least as a Beatle. And Epstein started out managing his family's furniture store, basically. He wanted to be an actor at one point. He was at his therapist, and he confessed to his therapist that he was gay. The therapist brings in his father and says, you need to get your son out of Liverpool. This is not a good place for you to have that particular sexuality. So he was always trying to find himself. He was ostracized. He came back, and he started this, basically, record store. And sort of the old cliche is that someone came in, asked for a recording by Tony Sheridan and the Beat Brothers. Epstein didn't know who they were, went to the Cavern. That's not really true. He would have known quite well who they were because they were on the cover of the second issue of Merseybeat, which he stalked. So he was always punctilious. He was up on what was going on around him. And yes, he did go to the Cavern in the end of 1961, saw these four hellions, well, three hellions plus Pete Best on the stage, and thought, right, I want to be a part of this.
And what people may not know is it was not easy to get a record company to bite. He literally went to just about everybody in England before he could finally convince Parlophone and George Martin to give them a shot.
What people tend not to know is they had gone 0-3 already at EMI, and George Martin just happened to be like on holiday when the EMI person was going around asking anyone if they would care to take a look at this band. And George Martin on the Parlophone label, it's like novelty records, comedy records. He did a lot of sort of progressive, almost avant-garde classical things. It wasn't like a marriage that you would think would make a ton of sense. And the joke was that they had been turned down by so many places, they were have to go on embassy. which was the Woolworth label, like our Walmart, like, or like Caldor. Like, I got a record coming out with Caldor, you know, like back when that existed. And yeah, it was tough sledding for them to get this. And then when Love Me Do came out in October of 1962, talk about how's this for handy, Epstein bought up 10,000 copies. That's really the reason it got to number 17 in the charts. And you wonder, like, if they didn't have someone to do that, what might have happened to them? Could it just have been over pretty early?
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about Brian Epstein, who passed away 50 years ago this coming weekend. He also understood the importance of making it in America, but that was a daunting proposition. We think about the British invasion being such a complete taker over of the charts, but so many British artists, guys like Cliff Richard, Lonnie Donegan, and others, had tried and failed to make it in America.
It was unthinkable. It was like almost, you know, me saying to you, oh, how about later today? We kind of hang out like on the backside of like Neptune. Like, we'll just go up there. We'll do something. It was so just beyond the pale in terms of possibility if you were English at the time. And their early records had gone over there. Please, Please Me and She Loves You and Capital was like, no, these are pretty rubbish. These aren't going to work at all. It was only with I Want to Hold Your Hand that they had the opportunity to go over to the States. And I think Epstein really viewed primarily what he did as the management of their tours. And when they decided to stop touring in the late summer of 1966, and that was going to be it at San Francisco's Candlestick Ballpark, Epstein turned to one of his helpers and on the airplane, he said, that's it for me. There's like nothing here. I'm pretty much done with this band.
And you mentioned his business acumen perhaps was not that great. There were some unfortunate deals. He basically, I think, gave away the merchandising. And then the publishing deal with Northern Songs really was not beneficial, especially to Lennon and McCartney.
No, it definitely wasn't. And McCartney said later on, after Epstein had passed away, that you have to be a little bit easy on him because he was someone who consulted his father on business advice. And his father was a guy who sold furniture at a store in Liverpool. It wasn't like this cagey, Alan Klein type, ruthless businessman that they'd have at the end of their career. I think, though, you'd have to say that the monies he cost them was far outweighed by, we all have a certain point in life where we need someone who's maybe in a different station of life to believe in us and to give us a chance, a little bit of prodding, a push down the sled. And Epstein gave him that. Now, he might have had like all sorts of reasons and agendas and for wanting to do that, that were maybe extra musical, something along those lines. But when they lost all that money, I think they looked back on it and said, well, we wouldn't have close to what we have if we hadn't had this guy.
And if I remember the timeline right, Colin, when Brian died of a drug overdose in 1967, wasn't that when the Beatles were up in Wales with the Maharishi?
Yes, they were with the Maharishi. They had had, talk about a tumultuous summer. Like June 1st, you have Sgt. Pepper come out. Like, well, this is very exciting. Later on in the summer, in the same month, you have All You Need Is Love on the Our World television broadcast, and you have the Apogee. That's really maybe not the height of them musically. Say that was like Revolver, the Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields Forever, AA single. But in terms of their ability to shake the earth, they were at the ultimate apex at that point. And then Epstein's gone in the end of, well, August 27th, 1967. They didn't attend the funeral because it just would have been a circus. So after that, McCartney basically spearheaded the band and became sort of the de facto leader. And I think he had to, but at the same time, as George Harrison would later say, that was when the rot began to set in.
Yeah, and with no direction, or at least not the kind of direction they had had from Brian Epstein, they got into things like Apple Records, but their Apple Store, which turned out to be a financial disaster. And then it wasn't long after that the whole battle with Alan Klein and with the Eastmans came into play.
You have Apple, you have Zapple, you have a character named Magic Alex, who basically hoodwinked them into thinking he was an actual wizard of electronics, like a sorcerer, like for real. And you had people coming in wanting to make terrible experimental films. And it's like when you're in high school, like you're a freshman and you're talking to like a sophomore, they're only like a year older than you, but they have like a certain peerage that you don't, and you listen to them. And I think that's what Epstein's role was with the Beatles. He was someone who could say no. Even as they became more and more successful, and he basically remained the guy they knew in the first place, it was someone who could put up a stop sign and say, like, okay, fellas, maybe not this. And there was no one to do that with something like Magical Mystery Tour. And you can imagine the pitch where McCartney's like, oh, let's just rent a bus. We'll drive around, and we'll film it, and it'll come out on Boxing Day, day after Christmas. Brilliant. I mean, who's like, okay, let's do that?
So the Beatles, as we know them, the talent was always there, but would they have achieved the levels of success they did without the influence of Brian Epstein?
I think of it almost something along the lines of, without the Tuck rule, would the Patriots and Brady have gone on to a great dynastic run? Like, but when you think about it, it's like, probably. It just would have looked a lot different, though, right? You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, it would have been, maybe it wasn't this year and this year, but it would have been this year and then a few years later. So I think that that career would have been there. Part of it was because I don't know what someone else like John Lennon was going to do with his life. McCartney was a well-rounded guy. You could see him becoming a stock trader or something like that. Lennon was going to be, I just think, a rock and roller. I think that was in the cards for him, whatever shape that took. But it wouldn't have had, people talk about, oh, the Beatles, they labored so long in Hamburg. Like, they put in a lot of hours, but they didn't work at something for decades. It was pretty meteoric. They went from that Love Me Do release in October. You have 1963. They just explode. She Loves You. I Want to Hold Your Hand. Please Please Me with the Beatles. And then they take over America fast.
Colin Fleming, always great talk with you. Thanks so much for making time with us this afternoon. We look forward to catching up with you again very soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rich.